This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It is the final Earth Matters show for the year today and we want to look back at the year that was 2020 and what an unsettling year it was. We lived and continue to live through the COVID-19 pandemic, which has caused massive economic setbacks, it's upended lives and we're still battling some other demons that never quite went away like the climate crisis. But if the pandemic has taught us anything, it is that people can rally together for the greater good. So joining me now to put things in perspective, as far as the environment is concerned, are the co-founders, co-editors and writers of environmental journalism portal Makaranga.org, Lau Yao Hua and Wong Siu Lin. Welcome both of you. How are you today?
They're good. Hello.
Fine, thanks, Juliet.
Yes, so this is usually our time for our monthly wrap-up, but of course we're going to do a sort of a look back at the whole year today instead. So I guess, you know, as I mentioned in my intro, of course, COVID, that just, you know, took everyone by surprise and that just kind of controlled everything that we pretty much did. And I think that had a huge impact on conservation, of course, and ecotourism, you know, things that we've discussed before. Maybe you can remind us, you know, all the things that you've come across, you know, through all your research, you know, and the impact that COVID has had on these particular segments of society.
Yeah, indeed. What a year, right? Okay. You know, for conservation and well, for everything else, no travel. But, you know, as things are opening up, how I hope that we can, do this wrap up in a much more happier atmosphere and say, oh, you know, looking forward to the new year, everything will be great. But we'll see.
How do you feel about everything, Siu Lin?
Yeah. We're going to try, I think, to not just highlight all the negative things, but some of the positives that have come out as a result of it being such a tough year, tougher even than normal for, you know, people in the environmental sector. Yeah. But so we did a bunch of articles looking at the impact of COVID on different sectors in the environment. And maybe I'll kick off with ecotourism and then Yao Hua can come in with conservation. Yeah. So in terms of ecotourism, as you said, yes, you know, because of the MCO, you can't travel, people couldn't travel, they couldn't travel overseas, they couldn't even rentas daerah, you know, they couldn't even go across state borders or even their little mukims, you know.
Yes.
You know, what do you do? You know, the thing is that what ecotourism experts were saying is that, or tourism experts were saying that people will want to go out, they will want to go close by, they will travel in smaller groups, they will seek nature because we all need clearer heads, calm and all that, and all these sorts of things nature can provide, you know. And of course, during the MCO, we heard stories of how the Klang River was pristine clear, turtles were coming up to lay eggs on beaches, you know. And the hope also is that with local tourism, it will help all the operators in the local tourism industry to revive. It might increase an appreciation for nature amongst Malaysians as well. But
there's always a but.
Everyone visiting nature. Two things, I'm just going to focus on two things. One is the pollution actually increased. Mm-hmm. So one of the first images I saw on Twitter actually was by an enraged conservationist in Penang, taking photos of litter on a beach that they had worked so hard to keep clean. And it was pristine during the MCO. And as soon as the MCO lifted, the litter came on, you know. And of course, we've all seen pictures of masks. We spoke about it before, you know, and how birds and marine animals have been entangled. So please cut the strings of your mask before you throw them away. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was also overcrowding. People all rush to nature. It doesn't exactly become calm anymore. And then that becomes a problem. But the other bigger thing in terms of the impact of the loss of income and livelihoods has been on ecotourism is that has that given rise to extraction, a greater extraction of natural resources? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because people have no money anymore. Mm-hmm. So I'll just highlight two areas. One is Kinabatangan in Sabah, where 90% of the tourists were Europeans. That dropped to zero until now. Apparently, workers from the nearby oil palm estate were hunting already in the forest reserve. The tourist presence actually helped to deter the hunting. But in June, when we spoke to the Sabah Wildlife Department, they said that officers are still monitoring, and actually there wasn't an uptick in forest extraction and stuff like that. Mm. Locals have said that, you know, the local Orang Sungai who depended on tourism, they actually have oil palm. Some areas of oil palm. So we're actually getting alternative livelihoods. And alternative livelihoods is absolutely crucial when it comes to the use of ecotourism for purposes of conservation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In other areas, people migrated. Basically, people who had no more jobs from tourism, they left. They left islands, they left jungles, and they went to work in factories. Yeah.
So just to chip in, I was in Kinabatangan in late June, right, for another story. And yeah, it was my first time there, so I had no idea, you know, how it was, you know, when it was at its peak, you know, lots of apparently, like, you know, thousands of tourists, you know, thronging the rivers, you know, looking at the wildlife there. But when I was there, it was so quiet. I mean, there was only one lodge or, you know, guest house or whatever you want to call it that was open. All the rest were closed. And the guides there told me that they were so grateful that the government let them dip into their EPF. They were so grateful. And to me, it struck me about, wow, you know, it was so important for them to get that. I think it was like just several hundred ringgit, right, at the time that they can dip into it. And they were so grateful for it. And so it just dawned on me, there are some localities, like some communities that were really, really dependent on ecotourism. Mm. And when everything went quiet, it was so tough.
Yeah, it went to zero income, like you said, right? I think I've even heard from friends, like, you know, some people in Bali, for example, who were their tourist guides or whatever, calling them and asking for favors because they had nothing, you know, absolutely zero income because there was just no tourists at all.
Yeah.
Really, well, I'm just going to close up with looking at a positive. Huh? So I'm going to refer to the Habitat in Penang. So it's an NGO foundation, as well as they run a wonderful ecotourist site up in Penang Hill. So they were 100%, they were dependent on tourist funds for conservation. And so, of course, when there were no tourists, you know, it was very sudden, it was immediate, and it was very long-lasting. They were completely unprepared for it. But they pivoted to technology. And this is true not only of them, but a lot of other NGOs as well. So they started a virtual tour series, and they were really surprised at the massive response that they had. And the other thing that tech has done is it's boosted efficiency. So in terms of decision-making consultation, this is from them, they said they actually managed to save quite a lot of money. So it's not only like you need to get income in, how can you cost save during this period, right? Yeah. And so tech has been, online platforms have been really effective in facilitating discussions. Mm-hmm. So they've had discussions on understanding COVID-19 and pandemics. They've had discussions on primate conservation, responsible tourism.
Yeah, so talking about income, right? So Makaranga, we ran a survey among the conservation and environmental NGOs in Malaysia. You know, we ran the survey in May, really asking them, like, we're trying to quantify, like, the impact of COVID on, you know, the activities or the sustainability of all these groups. And then we did, like, sort of like a follow-up in October. And, you know, what we found was that in May, so there was about, 1.5 months since the MCO started, right? Almost like many of the NGOs respondents were really worried before the MCO. About 2/3 of them had enough funds for the year, but 2 months into the MCO, you know, that 2/3 dropped down to about 1/3, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, more than, I think it was close to 80% of the respondents, you know, they were really worried about their funding activities for next year. Yeah, so this is for next year that they were worried about. And yeah, as Yulin said, right, many of the funding activities had to be cancelled, postponed, or somehow moved online. And one thing that was really concerning was that many of the overseas donors, you know, all these like huge international conservation groups, they had to divert their funds elsewhere, or they had to, you know, save up for, you know, what they thought would be an even worse situation. So that funding either stalled or were totally terminated. But, you know, there were silver linings. I know of several NGOs, like Celine described with the Habitat, that quite successfully pivoted into other forms of fundraising. So there's one NGO that quickly jumped on the wagon of making masks. So, you know, in this situation, the only two things that sell the best would be gloves and masks.
Yep.
So then they jumped onto that, and I think they have been really successful financially, and in terms of outreach, they have been really successful. So yeah, you know, it's great when these kinds of challenges give us incentive to really revamp and, you know, innovate and think outside the box.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great. But the worry is still there. I think we have not really quantified, like, how, you know, what portion of the conservation NGOs, big or small, would be laying off people, personnel, or would be even shutting down. we haven't quantified that yet.
Yeah. And I don't think we'll be able to for a while, right?
Well, I guess we can do another survey, but everything is still kind of fluid, right? Mm. You know, well, hopefully you will. Hopefully Earth Matters will have enough guests to interview next year.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
I mean, well, we've been hearing things like, you know, aside from the ecotourism, it's also impacted, I mean, like from the researchers that we've been speaking to, you know, it's impacted their research, of course, right? Because they can't go into the field, you know, so many things like that. Like you said, Yahua, you know, the funding from overseas has dried up or, you know, so many different struggles. But like you said as well, they've just sat down and had to strategize, you know, how to make the best out of a bad situation, I suppose.
Yeah, so Siulin is very optimistic, or perhaps a realistic veering towards optimistic. I guess I am realistic veering towards pessimistic. You know how, you know, we was all saying like, oh, you know, the calm during the pandemic gave the nature, you know, a time to heal. Yeah. You know, it shows that it's resilience, and there's like a dip in carbon emission, and it's great, you know. But two reports that came out since October showed that this dip that we saw in carbon emissions globally was real, right? So in October, there was a study that showed that in the first half of the year, it dipped by, I think, like 9% in global carbon emissions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Compared to the year before. So that's like 9% down in the first half.
Mm.
But then, just a few weeks ago, there's another report by the Global Carbon Project that shows that the whole year, there was a dip of about 8% or 7%. And we are already seeing signs that wherever the economy kickstarts, comes back again, you know, the carbon emission increases back to pre-COVID level, sometimes even exceeding the pre-COVID level. Mm-hmm. And most of this reduction in carbon emission actually came from reduced travel, airlines, you know, trucks, lorries, you know, and we know how eager the airlines are, you know, going, they want to go back into the air.
Yeah.
So yeah,
not just the airlines.
Everyone. Right?
Yeah,
even everyone. Like flying to nowhere. Imagine that. So
exactly.
Like, you know what to expect when the vaccine comes around. Yeah,
yeah. I think we're already seeing it. Right, as soon as the travel restrictions were lifted here in Malaysia, my goodness, the traffic jams will pop back. Like
yeah,
it was.
I'm smelling smoke again.
Yes.
But I guess if I'm smelling smoke, I'm also contributing to it.
Okay, I'm speaking today to Lau Yahua and Siulin Wong. They are both the co-founders, co-editors and writers of environmental journalism portal makaranga.org. And we're kind of doing a look back at some of the events from 2020 that concern the environment. And after this quick break, we're going to come back and talk more about, well, unfortunately, pollution, which was also a huge issue this year, and also some postponements to amendments of the Forestry and Wildlife Act. So that's coming up after this quick break. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today are Wong Siulin and Lau Yahua. They are the co-founders, co-writers and co-editors of the journalism portal makaranga.org, which covers environmental news. And we're doing a look back of some of the biggest events of 2020, of course, that concern the environment. So before the break, the biggest news of all, of course, we were talking about COVID-19 and its impact on conservation and also on ecotourism. But I think for Malaysians, most of us remember, or the headlines was kind of dominated by river pollution. And, you know, we had to deal with almost monthly water cuts. And, you know, it was just like, it was just cropping up everywhere. And it seemed to be like a consistent pattern. Just remind us, you know, what happened in this year that was.
Well, what happened this year was that for the first time in my life, you know, I live in PJ, right, Petaling Jaya, and for the first time in my life, I had to queue up to get water.
Oh, you know, my gosh.
I'm not sure if I'm fortunate or unfortunate, like, you know, this is my first time. But yeah, there have been, like, this year, there have been at least, like, 10 unscheduled water cuts in the Klang Valley, and 6 of them, you know, reportedly due to older pollution in the river, like, you know, Sungai Selangor. So it really feels like a monthly affair now. I'm totally expecting another one in the next few weeks, yeah. And it's not just in the Klang Valley, right? It happened in other states as well and other places. So, and it has really brought up a lot of problems that I suspect have been there, you know, under the surface. But now that we have to queue up like almost monthly for the water, all the problems are surfacing.
Yeah.
Such as, you know, why this river pollution, right? Why are all these operators, either licensed or unlicensed, you know, along the river, dumping all these like contaminants, you know, untreated directly into the river. Well, sometimes they dump it into the drain and that flows directly into the river. And the authorities have come up to say that they are really, you know, struggling to monitor river quality. And then now they're thinking of using like drones to collect water samples and to monitor the water quality. And to me, it's like the fact that we have to use drones to collect water samples. I mean, it sounds very high tech, but
yeah,
did we have to wait for drones before we are able to really monitor the water quality? So yeah, it has brought up quite a lot of like, you know, discussion points for the common citizens, really. Yeah,
I think amongst the areas, so I Johor's going to focus on the Klang Valley, and I'm you know, I took a look at Johor because there were problems there, and not so long ago, in fact, last year we had the infamous Sungai Kingkim incident, which of course was devastating to entire populations. Right,
yeah.
Children were affected, thousands of people were also affected, and that's like hazardous waste. So you know what Yahua said about factories and all that sort of thing. Definitely, what's going on there with the licensing, the use of drones? What's going on there with enforcement? In Johor, there were this year alone 140 complaints on river pollution. Now, these are complaints coming in from January to October, which violated the Environmental Quality Act. Huh? And what was interesting was the types of pollutions. So that was listed out by the state environmental council. And amongst the things that he talked about were things like river sand mining and dredging, farm pesticide, poultry farms, right? Looking at sewage, like what's going on with the sewage, right? Fishing activities like fish poisoning, leachate from landfills. These are some of the major factors of river pollution in Johor, right? Mm. And in Semburong, in Kluang, Sungai Semburong, there was bad pollution in June and July where the fish were found floating up on the rivers, and it affected Orang Asli. And out of that one incident in Sungai Semburong, 115 compounds were issued. 55 notices were issued, wow. Right? Uh-huh. And 26 notices for not managing scheduled waste properly. This is in Johor, like, you know, so what's going on?
Yeah. And obviously they've been getting away with it for a while if they're just doing it like that. It's like almost with impunity.
Absolutely, you know?
Yeah, in Selangor, well, not just in Selangor, you know, there's this, I think Sungai Kingkim was really the big event, right? The huge event that really brought all this into our attention. And it held our attention for quite a while, yeah? That the ministers, you know, ran to ground immediately. And so it was a lot of like, you know, drama and it brought our attention to it. But we need to continue looking at this, right? And one of the documents that we need to look at is this environmental quality report that is produced by the Department of Environment. And the latest one I could find is the one for 2018. But actually, you know, looking at the 2018 report, the statistics for our river quality seems quite consistent for the last 10 years, you know, all the way to 2008. And that is about, you know, of the slightly more than 600 rivers that they monitor, about half of this, say 46 to 60% of the river sample were considered clean, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you take a flip side of that, it means about half to slightly less than half of the rivers that they sample, and that's almost 600, you know, more than 600 rivers, are considered either slightly polluted or just polluted,
yeah.
You know? Yeah. So it's quite worrying. I don't know. To me, it's like to think that, you know, half of our rivers are considered slightly polluted or very polluted. And that very polluted, you know, category can be like 10%, you know, going to 13% at some years. So it's mind-boggling or worrying, actually.
Yeah.
I was going to add, in Johor, its capacity, you know, in Johor. So the Johor DOE, again, have said there are 126 rivers in Johor. They only have the capacity to monitor 23 river basins.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So apparently Malaysia has almost 3,000 rivers. Malaysia, yeah, this is the whole of Malaysia, has almost like 3,000 rivers. And they are only monitoring 638 rivers. I think monitoring actually spiked in 2018. Before that, it was like 400 and, it was about 500 rivers monitored. Then in 2018, it went up to 638. Yeah.
Gosh, that's terrible. And I mean, it's quite a lingering problem, isn't it? And I know we always ask, you know, what are the authorities doing about it? And I mean, do we know anything about that? Can we actually hope for some cleaner rivers in Malaysia?
Well, as a result of the Sungai Kingkim pollution, the government invested, this is the federal government, but I'm not 100% sure whether all the allocation came from them. They spent 7 million ringgit coming up with a real-time air quality monitoring system. Yeah, so that's an early detection system, which they put in the Pasir Gudang Industrial Estate. And so that's kind of a pioneering effort. Recently, I think a few months ago, the new minister of CASA actually went down and he spent an hour looking at this equipment as well. It was installed by the previous government, Pakatan Harapan, right? And basically, I spoke to an environmental consultant and basically she said, this kind of early detection system should be in every single industrial estate in Malaysia. And we have so many industrial estates. And as you know, the factories are all packed together. And really, there should be this early detection system in every single one of them. But we've just started putting them in.
Well, still, I guess that's a positive note, right? Yeah, well, we catch whatever we can, you know, grab the whatever you can. And in Selangor, the drones, right? Remember the drones? I'm fixated by this drone thing. And then, of course, the state government, just in early November, they have, the Selangor state government have responded by amending the Lembaga Urus Air Selangor enactment, I think it's like 1999. So they have imposed harsher penalties for wrongdoers, you know, for river pollution. So now if you are convicted, you'll be fined no less than 200,000 ringgit. That's double of what was the previous fine. And then you have mandatory prison sentence, which I think is a lot more effective than the fines, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and then one great thing was that they also amended it, the definition of pollution to include contamination that affects the taste and smell of water at its source. So not just, you know, previously it was the disposal of contaminants or poisons into a water source, but now it is just contamination that affects the taste and smell of water.
Mm.
So, you know, regardless of whether it's considered contaminants or poisons, as long as it, you know, affects the taste and smell of the water at its source, then you have, you know, offended. You have breached the law. And so I think that's you know, much harsher penalties and it widens the net for enforcement.
Yeah, and if all things fail, you know, sue. So the Sungai Kim lawsuit is still going on, if I'm not mistaken. There's a $10 million lawsuit. I'm not 100% sure whether it's a class action lawsuit, but it was brought by a parent of a child who was very badly affected by the Sungai Kim incident, and that's still going on. And I think in Selangor, an MP had proposed actually carrying out a class action lawsuit, and she put out a clarion call for Malaysians who were affected by the Klang Valley water cuts to join her. You know, I'm not quite sure what's happening with that, but I think now we're hearing more and more of you know, the possibility of using lawsuits to try and tackle environmental problems.
Yeah, I think we heard about
that. If we can all like rise up to this call, right? All the citizens who are affected, you know, I'm not sure what's the environmental justice involved here, but if we can all sue, because like to queue up to get water, right? There's the inconvenience. I'm not even talking about the business loss, but there's the inconvenience. You know, we are younger, able people who can queue.
Exactly.
But then I have had to help like really seniors. Like, how could they carry the water? It's like crazy. It's like so heavy, you know? Mm. It's all these people. I don't mean the seniors. I mean the people who dump the contaminants into the water. Yeah.
Yes, I think you know, the bottom line is they've not had to face any penalties for it, right? They've just been getting away with it. So it is important to just keep stepping up the punishments for these kinds of things and just to let them know that they're not going to get away with it. But yeah, suing might be a way forward. You know, the more people that sue them, maybe they will be slightly more careful about how they dispose of their waste. But, you know, just moving on, guys, the other thing, you know, continuing on the theme of disruptions, of course, was all the political changes that the country faced, right? And that also led to the postponement of the very long anticipated amendments to the Forestry and Wildlife Act, right? So what, just remind people, you know, what this act was meant to do and, you know, have we seen anything come of it in this past year?
Yeah, the Forestry Act, the National Forestry Act 1984 is an act that, you know, governs how forestry is done in Malaysia and, you know, specifically how forest reserves. So I'm talking about the Hutan Simpan Kekal, the permanent forest reserves or permanent reserve forests, you know, how this forest can be gazetted or de-gazetted by the state authority. So it's all there in the National Forestry Act, right? And so, you know, we are all very concerned about forest loss. And this in this aspect, the National Forestry Act plays a huge role because if a forest reserve is gazetted, then it must be, well, or it should be sustainably managed. That means, at the very least, you cannot clear-cut permanent reserve forest, right? Any other forest reserves outside this, you can clear-cut if you want to by the state authority. So what's this proposed amendments in the National Forestry Act? There are several. The main ones being that before the state authority degazettes a permanent reserve forest, they need to do public consultation. They need to hold like a town hall to get feedback from the public stakeholders. And then the other important proposed amendment is that whenever the state authority wants to degazette a permanent reserve forest, they must at the same time replace it with another land of equal area. Yeah.
Yep.
So that's important. So that means, or at least on paper, if that happens, we won't be losing forest area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so those are the two, I guess, key amendments, proposed amendments in the National Forestry Act. Siling, you want to talk about the wildlife one?
Yeah, okay. So for the Wildlife Act, I think the big thing is everybody's hoping for harsher penalties to counter poaching. Because in other aspects of governance and life, indeed, things are actually moving. So in budget 2021 for next year, right, there's a $20 million allocation for biodiversity patrolling and protection programs.
Mm.
So these are collaborations amongst the Orang Asli Forest Rangers, armed police, armed army veterans, right? So they're going to increase it to 500 people. They're going to expand to... So it was being carried out in only certain areas like Belum and Ndau Rompin, right? The hotspots, especially for tigers. Now they're going to expand it to other hotspots and permanent forest reserves. And I think the wildlife director, this is in Semenanjung, Malaysia. So this focusing on Semenanjung, Malaysia. He said that they have identified 79 forest sites which are hotspots for poaching in a tiny area of Peninsula Malaysia. These are the hotspots that they have already identified.
Okay.
So you really need the patrols to be going out. You need the law to be coming in and doing something about it. Yeah. So right now, the maximum fine is 50,000 to not more than 100,000 ringgit, and imprisonment is maximum 2 years. Yeah. They want to increase it to maximum imprisonment of 15 years. And increase the fines to 1 million ringgit, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the big thing is online trading. They're going to include the online trading of wildlife or illegal wildlife parts and wildlife as a whole into this act. So we really want that to come on board because, you know, right now there isn't any act governing online trading.
Yeah, you just go to Facebook, you can see it happening there. And yeah, it's just so blatant, it's so open. And this, and yeah, again, they're getting away with it, right? Because there's no legislation in place.
Yeah.
Yeah. So these are all, I would say, like amendments that conservationists and, yeah, I guess environment lovers, you know, would just concerned citizens would really want to have, right? Because it definitely empowers public interest in protecting our environment and also empowering the authorities, right, to carry out the duty that I'm sure they want to carry and they should be carrying out. But unfortunately, this year, partly due to COVID, but perhaps even more due to the political, disruptions, tremors and instability in Malaysia, these amendments have been postponed at least twice now. And in this most recent sitting, I've been checking. I don't think it was brought up also, like all these amendments, right? So, and why it was postponed? The reason given was that because this has to go through, at least for the National Forestry Act, the amendments have to go through the Prime Minister and then the National Land Council. Yeah, and then I think also the AG Chambers.
Mm.
And then it will be brought up to the Parliament.
Mm.
And so there were delays there with changes in government. And so I'm not sure when we will see this tabled. Really, really hope. Well, I'll just stop short there. And I just say that we really hope to see this, tabled in the parliament. I think everyone is for it. It seems like, you know, in the previous government and the National Land Council, which is, you know, composed of the Menteri Besar of all the states and the Prime Minister. I mean, they have agreed to it in, you know, before the changes in government in February.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to add that, you know, while all this, dilly-dallying and delays are going on, we actually have other laws that maybe we should look at using. And I think there's an increasing call for the use of the Anti-Money Laundering Act, this AMLATFA, which is deals with money laundering, terrorism, financing and proceeds of unlawful activities. Because I think certainly where the Wildlife Act is concerned, and even like, you know, the theft of things like gaharu and all that from forests, you know, a lot of these networks are huge organized crime networks, you know, and it's been recognized, which is why they've been sending in armed forces, because, you know, these guys, not people to play the fool with, you know. So they're now looking at the finances, and there's an increasing louder call for the use of this act, this Anti-Money Laundering Act, to do something about any sort of criminals, basically, that are going in for, either for poaching or to steal forests and stuff like that. Well, we came up with, where forests is concerned, we've come up with a huge piece called Forest Files. This is a four-parter, which I think Yao Hua will be coming on to talk quite a lot about. But, you know, why do we need laws? Let's look at the processes of how logging, land use change and all that are being carried on in Malaysia. And there's a very in-depth thing that we've spent a lot of time doing. So come on to Makarangka and have a read of that and understand why laws need to be changed.
Definitely. And, you know, another huge thing, you know, with which kind of, you know, takes all of this into consideration, of course, is the Kuala Langat North Forest Reserve. You know, there was plans to degazette it, and that went through the, you know, all the processes that are in place. And it kind of showed some of the pros and cons of having these laws in place, right? To have the public feedback sessions, you know, to have that whole feedback process. But maybe you can just remind folks about why it's important to have all these public consultations before a degazettement of a forest reserve takes place.
Yeah, so you're right there, Juliet. About the public consultation before the gazettement, right? Selangor is the only state in the whole of Malaysia that requires this, right? That they have actually put this into their state legislation. And we see this demonstrated in the Kuala Langat North Forest Reserve. As you mentioned, there was a town hall meeting where the public, the stakeholders, invited or not, were able to voice their concerns or their opinions on the matter. Of course, that's great. That gives a platform for the stakeholders to share their views, and it's public, right? You know, there were media reports on it. So I think it's really, really great, especially giving a platform to voices that, you know, minority voices, you know, marginalized voices, and definitely voices of the people who are living in the forest, right?
Yeah.
That's so important. But then it also shows the, I guess, the limits of this public consultation, which is, of course, obvious right from the start, is that the authorities only need to consult, I guess, and listen to this feedback and these opinions, but they are not obliged to, I guess, heed or follow these opinions, right? But that is the hope. That is the, I guess, that's the power of the people, right? The power to vote. So it definitely showcases the pros and cons of public consultation.
Yeah.
I was just going to add on to that to say that, you know, everything's on public record. The thing about having a public consultation that is that now with social media, it's on public record. So if it's there, people can refer to it. There are now extended campaigns to carry on. And they're quite powerful campaigns, actually, to enlist even ADUNs and, you know, Selangor State ADUNs and, of course, the greater public to really, really do something about this, to stop the degazetting of this this area. And I think that's important, that everything, if it's a public consultation, it's on public record. Campaigners can use it, the pressure, they can continue putting the pressure on. So I think it's in tandem with continued campaigning and continued lobbying of decision makers. So this is going to be very interesting, because I think it might be the first time, although I, you know, happy to be corrected about this, that state legislative members are actually voicing out in a public consultation about a decision made by the state government.
Yes, that's right.
I think that's very interesting. So
even if it's like within their own party lines, right? Like, you know, so they are breaching, I guess, sort of like the party line to voice their opinions against this degazettement.
So public consultation taken together with this entire case of what's happening is going to be very interesting, I think.
Oh, by the way, if I might add, you know, in the Kuala Langat case, right, there's a public consultation, there's a town hall, who's on the stage? So on the stage are the, you know, representatives of the state government, right? I would say, but I don't see the state exco member who is holding the land and natural resources portfolio on stage. In all states in Malaysia, that portfolio is held by the Menteri Besar, So I would say, and forest falls actually under that, you know. Mm. And so I would say it should be whoever is holding the portfolio of land and natural resources in every state, they should be the one on the stage to, you know, handle all the questions and to take all the opinions. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, it's been quite a year. And, you know, usually in our sessions, we always try to look forward to, you know, something positive in the coming month. Maybe, you know, some things that you're hoping for in 2021, guys, and things that we can look forward to.
Well, two very big things that were actually postponed from this year. So this year was going to be the big environment year, right? Yeah. Because two very big international meetings were supposed to happen this year. Well, we really hope they carry on next year and they somehow make a splash in the midst of vaccines and more COVID and all the rest of it. And of course, we're talking about the Conference of Parties for the Biodiversity and Climate Change, you know, the very big meetings. So we have the BioD one, which is scheduled for supposedly May. But when I just checked the website just now, they haven't actually put a date down. So they've just said the second quarter of 2021. That's going to be held in China, in Kunming. And the second one, of course, is the climate change meeting, which is scheduled for November next year, again in Glasgow, back in the two places. And they just had the Climate Ambition Summit, looking at countries pledging, as some of the NGOs say, you know, it's time for action. This is not any more pledging. But countries representing about 65% of, you know, those global carbon dioxide emitters, around 70% of the world's economy took part in this Climate Ambition Summit. So something did happen this year, which is good in preparation for the COP next year. They have committed to reaching net zero emissions, or what they call carbon neutrality, by early next year. Well, it's a pledge. Let's see whether they actually take action about that or not. In Malaysia, climate change and environment has disappeared from names of ministries. Well, climate change has disappeared from the name of ministry. Environment is still there. And environment and climate change have disappeared from any kind of bipartisan parliamentary select committees. Mm-hmm. So that's maybe not such a good sign for Malaysia. Yahua, the pessimist, do you have anything pessimistic?
For my side, you know, I'm looking forward to see how the governments, you know, state and federal governments, are going to use the budget 2021 to achieve, you know, sustainability, right? The sustainability factor was like a core part of the budget that was, you know, just passed. And, you know, some things in there would be like, you know, there's this fund, I can't remember how much it is now, allocated for meeting the sustainable development goals. And then there's that 70 million allocated for what they call the ecological fiscal transfer. Mm-hmm. There's a sum of money to compensate or to pay the states for protecting their forest. So I would like to see reported actually, like how that money will be used and hopefully is used to achieve those conservation and environmental sustainability means that we all really aspire to.
All right. Well, thank you so much, guys, for joining me. I mean, we've been doing this since May and we're going to continue doing this in 2021. So we'll be catching up with you at the end of January. But, you know, if you'd like to keep in touch or if you'd like to find out what these two are working on, just head to makaranga.org. That's makaranga.org. And if you miss any part of today's interview or any previous Earth Matters interviews, you can always search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. You can also find us on Google Podcasts and Apple Podcasts. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.